Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, good morning. We have a full house today. My notes tell me that we have Monticello High School here. Is that correct? And if so, would you stand, please? Oh, wow. It's a big group. Very nice. Please be seated. Also, Lafarge High School, are you all here? Oh, wonderful. Very good. Well, I see some people in the back that didn't stand up. Is there another high school or other students here? No? Okay. Well, all visitors are welcome, so that's just fine. This afternoon it will be around noon or 12:15. When we get done with the second argument this morning, Justice Rebecca Bradley here at the end of the bench will stay and chat with whatever students and anybody else that wants to come and talk about how cases are proceeded upon through the Supreme Court. So if you can stay, please do. With that bit of preliminary matter in place, I'll call our first case, State versus Dalton. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? Please do. Yes, please.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I am Hannah Schieber-Jurse, and it is my great privilege to be here today on behalf of Mr. Patrick Dalton. I am going to be focusing my argument on three main points. First, police lacked the exigent circumstances necessary to excuse their failure to obtain a warrant. Second, Mr. Dalton has met his burdens to show ineffective assistance of counsel for his attorney's failure to raise a McNeely challenge. And third, the sentencing court improperly criminally penalized Mr. Dalton for holding the government to its constitutional standard. First, in McNeely, the U.S. Supreme Court made clear that in drunk driving investigations, where police officers can reasonably obtain a warrant before a blood sample can be drawn without significantly undermining the efficacy of the search, the Fourth Amendment mandates that they do so. It's not an option, it's a constitutional requirement. McNeely represented a dramatic shift in Wisconsin for drunk driving investigations, but did not represent a dramatic shift in the Fourth Amendment. One of the fundamental principles of the Fourth Amendment is that warrantless searches are presumptively unreasonable. And what McNeely explained is that the same is true when it comes to drunk driving investigations.
Counsel, do we need to reach Washington County's procedure for obtaining search warrants?
I think that's a significant part of the issue here. The nature of Washington County's procedure, which in essence makes the warrant a warrant in what I'll call the warrant window for drunk driving investigations all but impossible to obtain, I do think is a problem under McNeely.
For us to rule in your favor, would we need to find that their procedure is unconstitutional?
I don't think the court would have to find that. I think even in light of the procedure, which demands in-person presentation of warrants, I still think that had the police recognized and acted as though the warrant was a priority from the point they had probable cause, it still could be attainable. But I do think the nature of the Washington County's procedure is a significant part of McNeely's totality of the circumstances analysis.
So let's concentrate for a moment on the the ability to obtain a warrant under the existing procedures in Washington County. Over what would you have the police prioritize obtaining a warrant? What was less important that evening than getting a warrant?
Sure. So having an officer wait for a tow truck where you have 10 to 15 firefighters assisting with traffic and safety was less important. Having an officer go to the hospital where the passenger was taken, where two police officers had already gotten a statement from the passenger on the scene, and then waiting as the passenger received a CT scan to get him to sign medical release forms. McNeely would tell us that both of those things should be less important because the warrant has to be a priority. We don't in any way fault the police, and we recognize and commend the police for prioritizing medical emergencies. And this court has also recognized that investigation necessary to determine whether probable cause existed is something that would, of course, come before a warrant. But police at every step in the process here prioritized everything over even an attempt to get a warrant.
Well, Counselor, what about the three-hour rule where the test would be admissible if submitted within 3 hours and perhaps admissible otherwise, but only with expert testimony? Should we be concerned about the three-hour rule?
McNeely does say that the three-hour rule is going to be a factor for courts to consider in evaluating the reasonableness of the police action. But I would note here that in this circumstance, police had probable cause within minutes of arriving on scene. And so this wasn't a situation as in this court's decision in Tolberg, where it wasn't until 2.5 hours, close to three, that police ever had probable cause. Here, police had probable cause within minutes of arriving.
Counsel, I'm a little concerned that if we start parsing out what the police did on that evening, mm-hmm. that we might be putting ourselves in the place of determining what is reasonable in securing the scene, providing for public safety, and attending to matters related to the passenger as well as the suspect. How do we go back in retrospect and evaluate that that crime scene and say to the police, well, you know, you got your priorities wrong, and here's what you should have been doing instead of waiting for the tow truck and securing the scene? You should have been going off and getting a warrant. Is that something that we are qualified to do?
So I want to start by saying that I understand the difficult work of police and that they have to make on-the-spot decisions. And I also understand the hesitancy of courts to feel as though they're second-guessing police action. But the Supreme Court was aware of all of that in McNeely and held that the police, like all of us, are bound by the Constitution. And so whereas in situations such as this, the police made no effort at any point to even try to get a warrant, courts will have to step in and hold police to their constitutional standards. And so it's not second-guessing the police here to say that the warrant can't be the lowest priority. There will always be, in every drunk driving investigation, there will always be other things that the police want to or need to do.
True enough,
Counselor. But we have to let the police adhere to the statutes and ask him whether he'd consent to a blood draw. And, of course, he was in Milwaukee County Hospital. The accident happened in Washington County, so you've got to get a warrant from a Washington County official and take it to Milwaukee County. But he hadn't even been asked until he was in the hospital. He might have said yes.
So our implied consent statutes create a system of notice for the civil ramifications of declining a blood draw. The implied consent statutes don't in any way alter or narrow that warrant window. And what I think is important for the court to consider is that in McNeely, the U.S. Supreme Court was well aware and specifically noted that all 50 states have implied consent laws, and the court did not explain that police only need to consider starting the determination of getting a warrant if and when a person refuses. On the contrary, the court explicitly rejected an analysis where that warrant window would only look at the time between arrest and the ability to get a blood draw. And the reason that the court declined to limit the window there was because the fear that that would distort law enforcement's incentives in both directions. So on the one hand, the court was concerned that that would disincentivize police departments from coming up with and using efficient ways to obtain warrants. And on the other hand, their concern was that if you make that window so narrow, that there will be circumstances where police prioritize getting a warrant over something else that truly is an emergency.
Counsel, do I infer correctly from your recognition that the police had a number of things to take care of that evening, that you are not making any claim of intentional disregard of your client, Mr. Dalton's, constitutional rights?
Well, we don't have anything in our record that shows that the police...
You can just say yes or no. I mean, you can, but if you want to, go ahead. I'm just trying to conserve
right.
time, that's all. Your time.
I don't think our record reflects an intentional disregard for the warrant requirement, but it does reflect that police at no point ever attempted to get a warrant.
So are you making an allegation? Do you think there was bad faith here on the part of the law enforcement officers?
I think that where the Constitution required the warrant to be the presumption, and police at every point along this process made no attempt to get a warrant, in a procedure in a county where the warrant is all but impossible, I don't know that I would call that bad faith, but I do think it makes the warrant the exception, not the rule.
So you think it was the policy of the county? You're saying all but made it impossible? The policy of Washington County made it all but impossible. Is that what you're telling us?
So the circuit court noted that in deciding...
I'm asking what you're telling me.
The policy and procedures of Washington County in this sort of circumstance where someone is taken to the hospital made it all but impossible for police to get a warrant within that three-hour window.
You say taken to the hospital. He was taken to the hospital by Flight for Life in a helicopter, right?
Right.
Okay. And so he was taken, as the Chief Justice alluded to, from Washington County to Frederick Hospital. Frederick is where? West Allis, Wauwatosa, I don't remember.
I don't know that off the top.
Do you know how many miles he was flown?
I don't know how many miles. I do know that Deputy Stoltz testified that it took him about, he estimated, 25 minutes to get from the scene to Frederick.
Okay, so Deputy Stoltz had to see to the clearing of the, as I recall the record anyway, Deputy Stoltz had to see to the clearing of the location right off a highway to divert traffic to make sure that the Flight for Life helicopter had a safe place to land.
Deputy Stoltz did not do that. He stayed on scene, and Sergeant Vanderheiden went to the Flight for Life scene, which was about a mile away.
Okay.
And Sergeant Vanderheiden was the only one of the five officers involved who went to the Flight for Life.
And Deputy Stoltz was just standing around?
He testified that after Mr. Dalton left, he examined the crash scene for a few minutes. And then after Mr. Dalton was taken, he drove to the hospital.
Let's talk about your presumption that you're imputing McNeely requires. I'm looking at page 1569 in the Supreme Court Reporter of the summary, the text of Missouri v. McNeely of the holding. And what it says is as follows. The natural dissipation of alcohol in the bloodstream constitutes not only the imminent but ongoing destruction of critical evidence, period. That would qualify as an exigent circumstance, except there may be time to secure a warrant before blood can be drawn, period. If there is, an officer must seek a warrant. Okay, so the presumption is, if there is time, the officer must seek a warrant. If an officer could reasonably conclude that there is not, the exigent circumstances exception applies by its terms, and the blood may be drawn without a warrant. Is that familiar with, is that consistent with your understanding of the holding of the McNeely Council?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. So what is the presumption that you are drawing from that?
The presumption is that the Constitution demands that police get a warrant unless they have exigent circumstances.
Unless they have a reasonable conclusion that there is not time to get a warrant.
Right.
Okay.
And here the conclusion was unreasonable because probable cause started here within minutes of police arriving on scene.
Counsel, but you did say, I believe, just a few moments ago, that Washington County's procedures, when applied to circumstances like this, made it all but impossible to obtain a warrant.
Right.
Right? Okay. So if that is the case, that pretty much describes exigent circumstances, unless you want us to hold that Washington County's procedures are constitutionally deficient, doesn't it?
I think there could be circumstances. It seems that if everything is happening in very close proximity where the procedures would not be per se unconstitutional, I do think it creates a significant problem that these procedures made the warrant the exception, not the rule. And I'd also point out that in McNeely, the court specifically addressed the fact that it wanted to incentivize efficient practices in obtaining warrants. Wisconsin has had in our statutes that police can use telephonic warrants, electronic warrants since 1988. That's 30 years ago. So the in-person presentation of warrants within that three-hour window, I do think, in almost all circumstances, will make a warrant impossible, and that is a problem. To Your Honor's question, I don't know that in every single circumstance this Washington County's procedures would create exigency, but I just point to what the circuit court said here in deciding our motion, which was that from the point of dispatch, it was almost certain that police would not be able to get a warrant. That's a problem under McNeely.
Counsel, there have been responses you've made to questions that include essentially this, that these procedures, referring to Washington County, made it the exception, not the rule. Mm-hmm. Paraphrasing.
Sure.
Also, the county procedure made it, and you've used this phrase several times, all but impossible. I want to make sure that I understand your argument. Mm-hmm. Earlier on, I understood that your argument was it is the totality of the circumstances which include the Washington County procedures and not exclusively the Washington County procedures that make this unreasonable.
Right. So. And that's what I mean when I say that there may be circumstances where that procedure enables police to obtain a warrant within the warrant window. And so the procedures here are one part of the totality of the circumstances, but I think in considering those totality of the circumstances, the fact that these procedures do make obtaining a warrant within that time frame seemingly so difficult, that is problematic. But it's not the problem isn't the procedure alone, it's the procedure in these circumstances. I think just one other point to note about McNeely, it's informative that in the oral argument in McNeely, and the court has the transcript of that available on its website, the government noted that, look, we're not in a world yet where police will always be able to obtain a warrant in 15 minutes or less. And Justice Scalia, who sided with the majority in McNeely, said, you don't need a warrant, you know, or if the court says, quote, you don't need a warrant, you know, even if things improve, the game's up, right? And his concern that we see in the McNeely decision is that the court wanted to incentivize efficient ways for obtaining warrants, and that's what distinguishes this circumstance now today from the 1966 Schmerber decision. Chief Justice Roberts noted in McNeely, look, in 1966, cell phones didn't exist. Email didn't exist. So what's reasonable and the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment being reasonableness, that applies to the police as well. And as Your Honor, Justice Rebecca Bradley noted in the recent Frederick Smith decision, we acknowledge that the police are not infallible, and a police officer may intentionally or unintentionally infringe upon the constitutional rights of Wisconsin citizens. If that happens, it's the duty of this court to impose consequences for such violations.
Well, so are you suggesting that the deputy in this case should have disregarded the procedures that Washington County had in place for obtaining a warrant and perhaps called the duty judge and said, hey, judge, there's no way I or one of my colleagues can get to you in person. We have a terrible crash scene here. Law enforcement is otherwise deployed all over the county. Could you come to the scene and sign a warrant?
I think this officer testified that he was trained on McNeely basically as soon as it came out. So, yes, I think he has to know that McNeely is his guiding principle. And, frankly, insofar as he's relying on the police department's procedure, that still falls to the police department. We're talking about the government's actions against Mr. Dalton. So the police department's policy can't insulate the police department from McNeely. Turning to my second point, Mr. Dalton has met his burden.
Let me just ask something that Justice Rebecca Bradley's question came close to asking, and I thought you were maybe going to take the opportunity to respond to it. Okay, if you are not attorney Juris, you are officer Juris, and you are assigned to this scene of this crash that is so bad that the Flight for Life helicopter has to come, and you have to clear the roadway, you have to find people in a pretty bad way, and you have to make sure that people are going to live. You also know that McNeely is out there, and you are scrupulously going to honor everybody's constitutional rights. What would you have done?
So,
you have the exact resources that Deputy Stoles had at his command on that night. What would you have done differently?
So one example would be, instead of ordering Sergeant Vanderheiden to go talk to the passenger who multiple police had already talked to on scene and waiting for him to get medical release forms, I would have said, we need to try to start getting a warrant. Can you help me? As the chief officer on this, I'm going to ask that you help start preparing a warrant. Turning to my second point.
That's it?
Well, I think that's one example of the way that it could have been
different. You've thought about this for how long, and that's your only thing you would have done differently?
Well, I think
you would have interrupted someone from getting material witness statements
while
they're fresh in mind, and you would have diverted the attention of your investigating officer from getting the witness statement from the passenger. That's it. That's what you would have done differently.
I think that's one example, and they already had the...
I agreed, ma'am. I can count, to one. That's one example. I'm asking if you have any others.
Sure. I think instead of waiting for a tow truck to... having an officer wait for a tow truck to arrive, that's another example. We don't have in the record exactly what Deputy Anderson was doing, and there were the two other Washington...
I'm sorry. What was that about the tow truck? My colleague here was making some sort of noise. I couldn't hear.
So... Deputy Stoltz testified that they had a police officer wait for the tow truck to arrive. There are 10 to 15 firefighters assisting with traffic on scene. I think instead of having an officer wait for a tow truck to arrive, have that officer help prepare a warrant. Turning to my second point.
That's it? Two?
Let's see. There are the two other deputies at the time who are not responding to any other Category 1 investigations. So those officers could have been recruited. I think that's a good array of examples of what could have been attempted. And I think what's important here is that there wasn't even an attempt to get a warrant. It wasn't as if this was a situation where police tried and then some other emergency took precedence. There wasn't an attempt here.
What is your second point? Now,
yes,
you've been wanting to tell us that.
Now that you've given three examples.
Mr. Dalton has met his burdens to show ineffective assistance of counsel. So just a few points on this. Counsel here performed deficiently when she concluded that a McNeely motion would be frivolous, without legal merit. An objectively reasonable attorney in Wisconsin would know that this motion was not frivolous because McNeely itself contemplates this situation as one where police would could lack exigent circumstances. This was not a situation where counsel had a strategic reason not to file a meritorious motion. Counsel testified that she did not believe it had merit, that Mr. Dalton wanted her to raise this motion, and that if she had thought there were any grounds to raise it, it would have been helpful to raise because it would have eliminated the strongest piece of evidence against her client. As to prejudice, we have shown that if the motion would have been granted, there is a reasonable probability that Mr. Dalton would have gone to trial. This would have eliminated the strongest piece of evidence. Mr. Dalton testified that he would have gone to trial. We have a letter in the file that he sent to his attorney prior to his plea indicating that he wanted to go to trial and he had concerns about the blood draw.
Counsel, could I ask you to step back just for a moment the viability of a suppression motion?
Right.
We said in State v. Brar that implied consent is real-life, constitutionally sufficient consent to a blood draw. Given that, is there a reasonable likelihood that a suppression motion would succeed?
So my understanding of State v. Brar is that that holding was by a plurality, not a majority of the court. So that holding is not binding and does not change the analysis. And as Your Honor noted in State v. Brar, letting implied consent shape the constitutional rights of the people of Wisconsin would be reducing the rights of all of us to legislative graces. I would just note, that the circuit court did not find Mr. Dalton's testimony that he would have gone to trial incredible. And there's no evidence in the record to suggest that he would not have gone to trial had this evidence been suppressed. Turning lastly, and I expect briefly, to my third point, the right Mr. Dalton exercised here in refusing the blood draw is the right that all citizens of Wisconsin and of the United States have, and that's the right to hold the government to its constitutional standards. This does not prevent the government from acting. It merely requires the government to comport with the Constitution. And as the Supreme Court explained in Birchfield, this decision of whether to hold the government to its constitutional — I see my
— Yes, please, that's fine. You can finish up. Yep.
The decision to do this cannot be made on threat of being penalized in the criminal law, yet that is precisely what happened here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Justices.
Good morning.
My name is Dave Perlman. I'm the Assistant Attorney General and for the state of Wisconsin, and I'm representing the state in this matter. Listened to a very spirited discussion on exigent circumstances, and I'm prepared, willing, and be happy to engage. But I think we should step back before we do so and understand that this case comes to us within the rubric of ineffective counsel. So what I think we should do at this moment, as the law requires us to do, is to stand back and sit behind Attorney Herta and look at the decisions that she made and determine not whether the decisions that we might have made, but whether those decisions in this case was reasonable. Analogize it to a poker game, if you would. The first card arrives in the Dalton case. It's an interesting card. He refused, and we have a warrantless blood draw. If I'm a defense counsel, that's an encouraging start. McNeely is in full play. They better be able to explain why they don't have a warrant in a refusal case. The next card tells me what's at stake. It's also a pretty intriguing card, a .238. So not only does it seem like I have a legal ground to stand on, but I have a strong incentive to stand on it because .238 sounds horrific. The ace and the king in spades. The next card, an emergency setting from beginning to end. half of Washington County's resources are used in this case. My client is driving radically, smashes his health, his life in jeopardy. Fire department's called. He's transferred to another jurisdiction. That's got a very strong emergency feel. That's got a Schmerber feel. That's got a Howells feel. That's got an exigent circumstance feel. That's not a good card. The next card comes. We're in Washington County. Did the officer not comply with Washington County procedures? No, he did. Were there plenty of Washington County officers sitting on their hands? No, they did not. 11 officers, that's a lot. 9 preoccupied. Unfortunately for Mr. Dalton, but that's the way circumstances worked. On the day that he decided to drive like a maniac and get crashed, there were another person with a hit and run that required 4 people. There was a stolen vehicle. You have 9 officers on duty, all preoccupied. The officer, it has to go to the Friedert Hospital. He has to go from a different county to even visit with him. And finally, that .238 I was so excited about, that smoking gun, this case has more smoking guns than the OK Corral. Usually a .238 is my centerpiece. In this case, I'd make it the cherry. I got bad driving. I got a passenger talking about bad driving. I've got an officer who observes the defendant, observes the strong odor of alcohol, a passenger who says he's driving, and I've got a refusal. And not only do I have a refusal, I might add I have a refusal with some elan on the part of Mr. Dalton. We'll get to that later when we get to sentencing. All of a sudden, that .238 isn't that big smoking gun I was hoping. All of a sudden, that warrantless blood draw makes a lot of sense. The other 3 cards are bad. Okay, what do I call it? Meritless, frivolous? I call it, I don't have much of a chance to win. But I don't ignore McNeely. I know McNeely. I've read McNeely. I made a memo on McNeely. I talked to my client. My client's concerned. He should be. Warrantless blood draw. I read somewhere, I'm out. She looks at it. She reviews it. She looks at the totality of the circumstances, and she makes a judgment call.
In your game of poker with those 5 cards, does she fold?
Yes. I knew when I started poker that I had to follow all the way through, and there might be some rocky moments.
Well, here's another rocky moment. There's no downside to asking for the motion, right? In poker, you might lose something. But here, why not give it a go?
Well, again, you know, to me, I don't know in terms of, and the record is fairly silent. There wasn't much in the Mockner hearing as to her strategy other than she felt that it was a weak position. Like, I don't know, the record doesn't suggest any great extension. But, you know, there's money on the table. It's been done. We know that the state at least has their jacks or better. I don't think I have a good hand. I choose, in my opinion, it's not worth it to have that motion hearing. Now, some might have rolled the dice. But I don't think it's ineffective counsel in this case. Not when you recognize the situation, not when you have identified the problem, not when you familiarize yourself with the record, and a record that I think had officers acting responsibly and in concert and probably helped very much in keeping Patrick Dalton's best chances of being treated. I just don't think that's a situation where a decision not to file a motion comes even remotely close to ineffective counsel. But we want to discuss exigent circumstances. I have a few points to make on that, too. But what I would ask is that as you listen to me argue, and you folks know this, of course, but pretend you're watching Fox News or CNN, depending on how you like your news flavored. But there's a scroll underneath throughout my argument, and the scroll says ineffective counsel rubric, ineffective counsel rubric. But let's play exigent circumstances. What does counsel say? At 4 minutes, you had probable cause. It's a rare moment. A defense lawyer is jumping on probable cause that quick, but issues make strange bedfellows. I'm not so sure at that 4-minute mark they had probable cause. Now, Dalton compared the case to Lange. Well, Lange was a much stronger case. Lange involved police actually observing incredibly bad driving. Lange observed the officer have to accelerate his speed by 50 miles from what he was to try to catch this guy. Lange happened at 3 a.m. But being that as it may, he needed to see this person. He had one quick look at him. His emphasis was on that person's safety, as it should be, and not on procuring evidence about that person. That wasn't the time to do field sobriety tests. That wasn't the time to analyze him. And he finally did see him at the Friedrich Clinic. And at that time, he noticed the strong odor of an intoxicant and the eyes and the lethargy. But let's just say they had probable cause at 4 minutes. What does that mean? Dalton keeps saying that McNeely does not narrow the window of when you should get a search warrant. Well, wait a second. McNeely recognizes implied consent. It exists. This person has consented. He has consented, and not only that, he's unconscious, which under our statute means that not only is he consented, he's continuing to consent. Do you call up a judge saying, "Judge, I'd like a search warrant. Person's consented, but I'd like one for safekeeping. I'd like one for future means." If it's correct that the moment you get probable cause, you get a search warrant in an OWI case, you get a search warrant in every OWI case. That was before Justice Alito in Birchfield, and he slammed it down. He said, "Can't have that. The system would break." Nobody's asking for that. But if you're going to say 4 minutes PC, get a search warrant, that's what you're saying. The search warrant comes into play when implied consent has been exhausted. They read him his rights, he refused. That happened in hour 58. It was 1 hour and 2 minutes left. He's in the Friedrich Hospital in Milwaukee. Other officers are there. He's going to have to go back to Washington County. And I think the justices were correct in saying, well, the officer is not in a position to make an end run around Washington County's policies. And Washington County's procedures, let's remember, this is 8 months after McNeely. This isn't 4 years after McNeely. And they did change in light of McNeely because Washington County, up until that point, had gone with the bowling, which was the automatic exigent circumstances. You didn't need search warrants, and now you do need search warrants.
Counsel, you mentioned in your argument just now that the system would break. We can't do that. You also preceded that comment with some reference to the implied consent law. Are you advancing that the implied consent law equals actual consent? And if so, wouldn't the system break with that kind of argument?
A la Brar. Okay, I'm advancing and have advanced. I advanced in Brar,
right,
and was recognized in the lead opinion of Brar, that there's nothing second class about implied consent, that it has the same meaning of consent. And the argument I made in Brar, and I reprise here, the reason we call it implied consent is most people, when they get behind a car, don't announce that they understand this and that, but they're consenting to it. And what I'm saying is that under the implied consent, you do have the opportunity, if you wish, to break the law and face the ramifications of breaking that law. And then once you do that, now McNeely's in full play. Now you better get a warrant unless you have the excuse.
My question was a little more tailored than that.
I know, but I was sort of broadening.
That's
why. Let's go back to your tailoring.
That's right. You're wonderful. But that has nothing to do with the argument in this case.
Oh, it's always nice to hear. Yeah. I like you, too.
Yeah. Until you see her opinion.
Perhaps. Okay.
Okay, Justice Abramson, that was fantastic. It's a three-pointer.
Let's go back to the question.
Yes.
The question is, are you advancing that implied consent is actual consent?
Implied consent has the, yes, in the sense that implied consent means that this person has done something that circumvents the need for a warrant by consent. The warrant could come into play if he chooses to rescind that consent during the informant of the accused.
That's
but
right.
It has the same meaning as actual consent. Yes. I advanced that in Brar. I reprised that here.
That's right. But I ask, doesn't the system then, using your phrase, would break? Isn't there real, aren't there real consequences to a position of no need, as a general rule, to get a warrant? Perhaps no need ever to get a warrant unless in the rare situation where someone then revokes the consent.
Well, I interrupted, and I'm sorry for that.
Please.
But I would argue that in most drunk driving cases, the warrant is rare. Most drunk driving cases are handled by implied consent. Warrants are not the default position in an OWI case is we're going to have a warrant. Still the rare occasion, because of the consent that has occurred, and because when you read the informity accused form, not a consent form, mind you, the informity accused, it takes that rescission before, in my opinion, McNeely kicks in and says, now you better get the blood in a Fourth Amendment proper way, and that requires a warrant. But I don't see where the system would break that way. Person refuses, now you have to get a warrant. Most cases aren't going to involve this. I reject totally Dalton's position that it is impossible to ever have a situation where we can imagine where they would time to get a warrant under Washington County's procedures. I would argue it is very difficult to get a warrant in a case where you have a massive crash, airlift here, other hospital there, nine officers involved. Yeah, that would be tough.
Counsel, I want to ask you a little bit about BRA. Obviously, you know I'm interested in it since I'm the one who wrote the opinion.
And very well.
Plurality, though it was.
Yeah.
There was a lot of discussion and a lot of research that was done in my chambers, and it was a question that we never addressed in the opinion, so I'd like to ask it now. Is the implied consent constitutionally sufficient here? Because there is, as a general matter, the opportunity to withdraw it.
To me, so now what you're saying is the opportunity to withdraw, unlawful as it is, does that opportunity, is that a parcel of the constitutionality of the whole thing.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking you. We didn't address it at all in
No, Brown. We didn't. And it's interesting, and I haven't thought about it that much, contemplation. But so, seat of the pants, yeah, I think it's all part of the implied consent package. I think it made sense. Here's why I think it does make sense. Because, you know, I get behind the driving the wheel, and I turn that wheel, and I did imply my consent. But we could be talking 3, 4, 5 hours later, and to immediately from there said, you've consented, that's it, here comes a needle, I don't even think it's reasonable. So I like the fact that we read the form to remind them of what they have done and to give them the opportunity to do the wrong thing and force us to go to a warrant. That's the way I would conceptualize that.
So, counsel, if I understand correctly, you would say that the implied consent is constitutional because the defendant has the opportunity to break the law by withdrawing it.
No, he...
I don't...
I think he breaks the law by drinking too much, but he has the opportunity to withdraw it.
He breaks the law
by
drinking so much.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the execution...
Hang on.
Yeah.
So we say that it is unlawful to withdraw consent, right? Drivers have no right to refuse the test.
They have the opportunity to refuse. They can refuse. It's unlawful.
And we punish them for that.
Excuse me?
And it's unlawful to do that, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So what you're saying is that the implied consent is constitutional because the defendant has the opportunity to do an unlawful thing by withdrawing his consent.
I think the reason that and I know that sounds a little counterintuitive, but the reason I think that is true is because to just use their implied consent without a further discussion from the situation, it's not that common that the consent is not directly tethered to the search. There is a distance here. There's a time factor here. And that this reminder makes it more reasonable, to my view, to then go with the blood test. I think it might be unreasonable to not even talk to the guy and stick a needle into him and say, you consented earlier. So, yes, in effect, that's, I think, part of the constitutionality is in the reasonableness of executing on the consent.
Part of, but I didn't understand that we were debating the constitutionality of implied consent.
No, but it's an interesting... Yeah, we were not. And the to my knowledge, I have never seen yet in front of this court that the implied consent...
It just seemed to me you were making sort of a collateral humane argument about coming at someone with a needle unforewarned.
Right. I'm just saying that I think, to me, the implied consent...
Right. To you, which is very nice, which is why maybe Justice Ann Bradley noted what a wonderful person you are. So maybe you want to move on to your next point.
Well, that's because he lived in Wausau also.
Okay. I stand corrected.
Are we determining today whether the implied consent statute is constitutional?
We're kind of determined today whether their attorney, Herta, was ineffective for finding that the motion hearing on an exigent circumstance would be problematic. And again, we're, you know, these are side-tailing discussions here, but I think we can never lose track of the ineffective counsel rubric of a lawyer who is aware of the case, who reads about the case, who memos about the case, who talks to her client about the case, who reviews the reports, and I believe that the reports suggest the situation of screaming.
Do you think one of the reasons she doesn't want to make a meritless argument is she wants to preserve her credibility with the courts in general and specifically the court she appears in on a regular basis?
That's an interesting point, and I think there's a lot of things that go on in an attorney's mind in deciding whether to go forward or not. First and foremost, I think you do want to look at the best interests of your client. Sometimes it's your experience that tells the client, I don't think this motion has a chance. And sometimes you say, I'll never raise that because I'll lose all credibility with the court. I don't know if this was this case. I believe that the Court of Appeals was probably correct in Dalton 1 saying, anytime you've got a warrantless blood draw after refusal, take a peek, see what's going on. And they did in the Mockner hearing. So I think that was going on.
And as long as it's the product of a rational thought process and someone is, and the attorney has thought it out and thought about the pros and cons,
yes,
and in this instance determines that under the facts and circumstances where not only are you trying to save the life of this person under very distressing circumstances, but you have other emergencies going on and the two or three hypothetical scenarios posed by your opposing counsel where things may have gone differently, notwithstanding, none of us having been there, and nowhere in McNeely or anywhere else is the standard of perfection imposed upon investigating officers, but yet reasonableness, because as we all know, I don't see too many fresh faces on the bench or standing behind that podium. That's the best we can hope for from anyone, is reasonableness. That's the standard we've got.
Yeah, I agree with you, although a little turn back that you don't find my face fresh. But
you've already been found wonderful.
But no, I agree with you. And that's this case involved. This case not only has the reasonableness within the exigent circumstance, but then the reasonableness within the attorney performance, and then giving great deference to what the attorney did. I just do not see an effective counsel here.
So, counsel.
Please.
Thank you. When we look at this in the ineffective assistance of counsel context, do we need to get to what the chances of success would have been for the motion, or do we just look at, well, she looked at it, she considered the factors that go into it, and decided not to, and therefore that was a reasonable exercise of discretion? Do we get to the question of what were the chances of success?
I think you do. If she could be, as she could, let's say the report showed nothing, standard variety, OWI, 1 hour in, and she read McNeely and said, I don't think McNeely overrules Bowling. We have no chance. Well, she might be reasonable to her. That would not be reasonable to us. That would be just ineffective. It's in the soup. I think that courts justifiably get upset with counsel when they don't look for witnesses, or they don't do this, or they don't do that, or if she said, I never read McNeely, or I don't know anything about McNeely, or I never talked to Dalton. Those are the kind of factors. But in this particular case, whether or not we filed that motion or not, she certainly was reasonable in deciding not to. I would like to address the Birchfield issue, if that's okay.
Of course. If possible, and I think it is possible, counsel, I'd like to go to the issue of Birchfield and directly ask regarding a couple of lines of the court's decision.
Yes.
Of course, the issue that we're looking at is under Birchfield, may a circuit court impose a harsher criminal punishment because a defendant exercised, the statement is, his constitutional right to refuse a warrantless blood draw. That's the way your opposing counsel has framed the issue. And the sentencing judge said quite a bit, but at the end, the judge said this, quote, and that's going, referring to, I'll read the whole thing. The other thing you did is anybody who drives a motor vehicle in Wisconsin impliedly consents to a blood or breath draw after they're arrested. And you were arrested and you disregarded that, and you will be punished for that today. You don't have the right not to consent, and that's going to result in a higher sentence for you.
Yes.
And it is those last three or four sentences that are the focus of the argument and cause me concern. Tell me why I should not be concerned about those last three or four sentences that I read to you that was spoken by the judge at sentence.
Right. First, in context, those sentences were articulated before Birchfield was decided, although reviewed again in light of Birchfield being decided. My feeling is that it is fair game to consider a refusal in an OWI second offense conviction sentencing hearing. I think the confusion comes in when we lose track of the fact the judge was sentencing him for OWI second offense. He was not sentencing him for refusal. Birchfield's problem was that it can't be a standalone. In other words, under Birchfield saying, let's say a person refused and beat the drunk driving rap. We can't have a case where now you can convict him of the refusal and put him in jail. It's too strong. Birchfield's also saying if you're going to use the refusal and only the refusal to expand the statutory maximums or minimums, you can't do that. But I see nothing in Birchfield to suggest that it can't be a legitimate sentencing consideration in an OWI second conviction case.
Counsel, Birchfield said this. It was after it expressed agnosticism about civil penalties for refusing a blood draw. It said, quote, it is another matter, however, for a state not only to insist upon an intrusive blood test, but also to impose criminal penalties on the refusal to submit to such a test. So it's referring to the penalties.
Yes.
Right? And there, at least, it's not referring to a prosecution for a separate violation of refusal. It's just penalties.
Right.
And Mr. Dalton received some criminal penalties for his refusal here, yes?
Again, I would respectfully look at that differently. I would say he received a higher criminal penalty for the OWI second than he would have if he had not refused.
But
he's not receiving, and the refusal is reflective of many things. It's
okay,
reflective
hang on,
of lack.
Hang on a second. So the circuit court said he's going to punish him for the refusal.
Yes.
So I take the circuit court at his word.
Yes.
And that he did punish him for the refusal. Why is that not a criminal penalty?
Well, the circuit court could say, I'm going to punish you for the fact you've never had a job in 5 years. Is that a criminal penalty for not having a job for 5 years?
Well, it may or may not be, but we have Birchfield here that says you may not give him a criminal penalty for refusing the blood test.
But again, because I do not think it's a criminal penalty to use other sentencing considerations, many of them lawful conduct as opposed to here unlawful conduct, I don't think that's imposing a criminal penalty because it wouldn't make sense conceptually that we're imposing a criminal penalty for a lack of remorse.
Well, and the statute provides an administrative penalty.
Yes.
Immediately, if you refuse, you lose your license.
Right. That's for the refusal.
Right.
That's the refusal.
That's right.
And
that is the refusal penalty, but it's administrative, not criminal.
Right.
I'm trying to figure out, you know, having done hundreds, if not thousands of these sentencing guidelines are promulgated in each district.
Yes.
For the judges to use when determining what sentence is appropriate in any given case. And it's my recollection, and maybe this has changed, but I thought the chief judge and a group of the district formed those guidelines for the entirety of the district to use. And while the refusal in and of itself is a ticket, and of course you could not give criminal penalties in imposing a forfeiture or a penalty related to that ticket, a consideration in the sentencing guidelines, and usually I think the very last column is refusals, because it falls in a different category than if you're fully cooperative and you say, sure, go ahead. You can have my blood. You can have my breath. You know, you take those tests. A refusal generally gives someone different penalties than if you otherwise consented during the entirety of the procedure. It's been my experience that it's very common, in fact appropriate, to indicate where someone is ending up on the guidelines. And it also factors into negotiations and outcomes and where people fit and know they fit so they can make recommendations that a court might reasonably consider. Did I miss something there? Has that changed?
Yes. No, you did not miss anything. But in preparation for this morning's hearing, I did look over the guidelines as of January 2017. And it seems to no longer have refusal in that grid. The refusal always was in the highest grid. It makes the most sense because you're depriving us the score. We're going to presume the worst because you could have complied with the law and then we would have known better. But my feeling is this. It's still listed as an aggravating factor, the failure to comply with OWI's implied consent law. It is an aggravating factor because it shows a lack of remorse. It shows a lack of cooperation and never... Is that more clear than in this case?
Those are essentially sentencing guidelines for courts to use in
OWIs.
Right?
Guidelines to use.
And so it always has listed the kinds of things that are mitigating factors, the kinds of things
mitigating
courts consider.
Mitigating factors, aggravating factors. It's still legitimate as an aggravating factor, and it doesn't necessarily put it in the grid. And I think for the most part, in the most cases, you're going to have, as you did here, a blood draw, and you'll have the score, and you can put that in the grid. But in answer to the Chief's question, I think I know what you're getting at, Chief. You're saying, well, the refusal is sort of its contained unit. Mm-hmm. You get the civil penalties, and then I think maybe it should be out of the play. And I would argue, no, the refusal by itself can do that. Birchfield says that's what a refusal can do by itself, the civil penalties. But it does nothing to say it can't be used as other things are used in a sentencing consideration, particularly when it shows a lack of remorse, a lack of cooperation, a bad attitude, which in this case...
Or on the converse, acceptance of responsibility is one of the most traditional hallmarks of a lighter sentence, of a consideration that a judge would use in imposing a lighter sentence.
Right. If you look at this particular case, Patrick Dalton drove terribly. He drove at an extremely high intoxicant scores of .238. He got into a crash. He used up, as I not told you, a lot of Washington County's resources. The emphasis was placed on keeping him alive. He goes and reads the implied consent form, and you don't need me to elaborate his response to that.
We don't hear about the lighter sentences when they cooperate, because no one's going to appeal when they cooperate with the implied consent law and the judge gives the lighter end of the grid, because no one's going to appeal that. Under acceptance of responsibility, but if there's the opposite of that, failure, refusal, then it seems to me that the circuit court ought to be able to take that under consideration as well.
Yeah, that's my position, is that thing, and I don't think that the big thing is, I can think, you can think, but I don't think Birchfield mandates that we cannot consider it as a sentencing factor.
Isn't the question then more narrowly tailored whether or not the court considered it as a sentencing factor or whether the court, in reading the transcript, imposed a harsher sentence because of refusal?
That's a difficult distinction to parcel out. But I think that and I can't speak for the judge, my suspicion is that after Birchfield was decided, he would do the same thing, but perhaps the language would be more about what
Isn't
it shows
it
about
job
lack of
the
remorse.
Reviewing court to look for reasons to sustain the decision of the trial court?
Counsel, I didn't hear what you said at the very end.
What I'm saying is that it's a difficult, what you just described is a difficult distinction to tease out as to whether you're punishing him for the refusal by using the word refusal, or whether you're punishing for what the refusal reflects, which is the lack of remorse, the lack of cooperation, all legitimate factors. I suspect in a post-Birchfield world, he did not have the advantage of Birchfield, he might go the extra step and say the refusal, you're being punished because it reflects A, B, and C. And again, in this case, it really reflected A, B, and C. This was a case, an extreme case, where if I'm a judge, I am not happy with that attitude and demeanor that he showed during refusal under these circumstances involving all that. I also do want to just say that I reject Dalton's premise that he is being punished for exercising a constitutional right. I see nothing in Birchfield that so elevates the refusal. Birchfield makes a distinction between refusal to a breath test versus my light is red.
Your light is red, yes.
So thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. May I indicate without taking time that I think you're wonderful, too. This is a happy day for all the lawyers.
Everybody else is going to feel bad today if they don't get that treatment.
Thank you. May I proceed?
Yes, please. Please do.
So starting with the sentencing argument,
okay.
Under the state's theory, a judge could say, you knew you were guilty, you went to trial. I'm giving you a higher sentence because of that. The police interrogated you and you invoked your right to counsel. I'm giving you a higher sentence because of that.
But under your theory, if I get a traffic ticket for speeding and I'm going 95 miles an hour when I have this crash, the judge can't consider that either because that's punishable by a traffic ticket.
No. Under our theory, what cannot be punished is the decision to hold the government to its constitutional burden. So the decision to say, I'm not going to give the government a pass around whether they need a warrant for this extremely intrusive piercing of the skin to take and keep a blood sample. I am making the decision articulated under the Bill of Rights that the government is limited to warrant searches unless a certain exception exists.
So is the refusal statute unconstitutional?
No, not the implied consent statute.
No, the refusal, the penalty for refusal.
In the sentencing guidelines?
No, in and of itself, to get a separate, have a separate violation for refusal, that must be unconstitutional.
With civil penalties.
That imposes civil penalties, and we take no issue with that. The problem, and that's what's articulated in Birchfield, is that there can't be criminal ramifications, that when a person decides whether to hold the government to its constitutional limitations under the Bill of Rights, that decision can't be made on fear that that will result in increased criminal penalties. And that's exactly what happened here. Turning to the ineffective assistance of counsel argument, this was not a situation where counsel thought this was a weak issue, but chose not to raise it. This was one where she concluded that it had no legal merit, that it was frivolous, and that determination was objectively unreasonable. Mr. Perlman also noted the memo in counsel's file that reflects the counsel's...
Let's talk about that a little bit. Let's just say counsel's it was incorrect in the choice to not file the motion. Given the findings of the court, where is the prejudice?
So if this court should disagree that the motion, the suppression motion would have succeeded, right, if this court should hold that the motion would not have been granted, I agree we would not be able to meet our burden to show prejudice.
Did the judge in this case indicate whether the judge would have granted the motion?
The circuit court judge? The circuit court judge indicated that the motion would have been denied, but this court
That's
is
what
not...
I thought. No, okay.
Right. This court isn't bound by the legal conclusions of the circuit court on that point. And so if this court should conclude that the motion would have prevailed, then counsel was ineffective because there was no strategic reason to not file this motion.
Well, it's not that the motion would have prevailed before that judge because that judge said it wouldn't. It's that on appeal, an appellate court would have found that that motion should have prevailed at the trial court.
Sure. If this court believes that the motion would have succeeded, then counsel was ineffective for not raising it. And just to point the court's attention to that memo that is in counsel's file, which is in the record as Exhibit 89, it notes Missouri versus McNeely, and then it says, and I'm quoting, held, warrantless blood test was reasonable here. Reason, evidence could have been lost because of the percentage of alcohol in the blood system begins to diminish shortly after drinking stopped as the body functions to eliminate it from the system. Court said in a case like this, where time had to be taken to bring the accused to the hospital and investigate the scene of the accident, there was no time to seek out a magistrate to secure a warrant. That's not what McNeely held. McNeely didn't address whether there were...
McNeely didn't address someone that had a .02 either, and a .02 alcohol, what is a .02 is what the person was at in Howe because of the, he's had so many other OWIs. So, you know, if you're going to be at .08, which is the legal limit for most folks, you may have a little time. With .02, you're going to lose any evidence of alcohol intoxication at all because you have so little there. Isn't that what Howe turned on?
This isn't a .02 case. I may be misunderstanding.
Yeah, well, I guess I was just misunderstanding your use of Howe. I think Howe has nothing to do with this case.
So I didn't mention Howe's. What I was saying is that counsel's memo, which is in the record, reflects that she said held, warrantless blood test was reasonable here in her analysis of McNeely. And so counsel, that memo shows that, or it seems to reflect, and I see my red light is...
Yeah, you can finish your thought. Yeah.
This memo, which is in the file, seems to reflect that counsel thought that McNeely concluded, the court in McNeely concluded in that situation, the police did have exigent circumstances, when in McNeely, the court didn't decide exigent circumstances. So this was her decision... or her conclusion that the motion was frivolous was objectively unreasonable.
Yeah. It also could have been her conclusion that putting the two together, that's how Howe fit, because Howe had such a low alcohol concentration, so therefore was consistent with McNeely.
She testified she didn't believe it had any legal merit, mm-hmm. such that she couldn't raise it.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you very much. Well, we know you're both wonderful because you've been told that several
right.
times through the argument, but your briefs were very, very good. And as usual, you both always give us good arguments, and they were very good today. So thank you. We're going to take a recess so that you can move and the new attorneys can come in, and I think some of the students will probably be leaving too. So thank you. Thank you very much.